To listen ad-free, visit us on Patreon at patreon.com/anatomyofamassacre, or simply click the support link in the show notes. You can also get this show ad-free on Apple subscriptions. See your Apple Podcast app for more details. Anatomy of a Massacre discusses topics that might not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is strongly advised. In the late 1970s, hundreds of Americans migrated to Jonestown, a remote settlement in Guyana established by the People's Temple. Under the leadership of Jim Jones, Jonestown became internationally infamous for the events that took place on November 18, 1978. On this fateful day in November 1978, a total of 918 people were killed in what Jim Jones called revolutionary suicide. Almost one-third of those killed that day were young children. Most of the 918 people killed died from cyanide poisoning at the Jonestown compound. Others were killed at a nearby airstrip, including U.S. Congressman Leo Ryan. The deaths at Jonestown on November 18, 1978, became the most deadly single non-natural disaster in U.S. history until September 11, 2001. Decades later, psychology experts, historians, and law enforcement continue to try and understand how so many people could be influenced by someone like Jim Jones. This is Anatomy of a Massacre, Rockefeller Audio's newest podcast series, episode number 2, The Jonestown Massacre. Anatomy of a Massacre is a true crime podcast investigating the most notorious massacres in human history, from serial killers to mass shooters to genocides. There's a new story to be told in each episode. As a one-woman show, your support helps me conduct research and assist with production and editing costs. As a thank you for supporting the show, you'll get early ad-free access to episodes, personalized shoutouts and episodes, exclusive merchandise, bonus content, and more. To learn about how you can support Anatomy of a Massacre, please visit patreon.com/anatomyofamassacre or simply click the link in the show notes. Other ways to support the show include leaving a positive rating with a review or telling friends about the show. Now, let's get to the episode. This episode discusses sensitive subjects, including suicide. Suicide prevention and resources are included at the end of the episode. Indianapolis, Indiana, 1955. The People's Temple was formed under the leadership of Jim Jones. Born on May 13, 1931, Jim Jones grew up working as a self-ordained Christian minister in small churches throughout Indianapolis. But he always knew he wanted to start his own church, despite not having any formal training. To raise money to create a church of his own, Jones used his charm, trying out different business ventures. At one point, he went door-to-door selling live monkeys to raise money. By 1955, Jones had the finances and the ideology to form his own church, the People's Temple. During a time when racial segregation was strong in America, the People's Temple stood out for its multicultural membership. Its founder, Jim Jones, had a vision for a communist community, a community where everyone worked for the common good. They practiced a mix of Christianity, communism, and socialism. They were different from every other church. The People's Temple operated social and medical programs for people in need. They offered free food, drug rehabilitation, and legal services. This type of charity work earned Jones a strong following among civil rights activists and young people who wanted to do something meaningful with their lives, an idea that Jim Jones promised his followers. By the 1960s, Jones and his family became increasingly paranoid and fearful, particularly about nuclear war. Sometime in the 1960s, Jones came across an article in Esquire magazine that listed the top 9 safest places to live in the event of a nuclear war. One of the places listed in the article was Eureka, California, a port city in Northern California. To persuade his followers to move to California, Jones warned them about an imminent nuclear war. He told his followers if they didn't move to California, they would all die in an attack scheduled for July 15, 1967. Believing that a nuclear attack was coming, Jim Jones, his wife, their adopted children, and 70 People's Temple followers set up a new home in Northern California in 1965. While in California, Jim Jones began to rise as an influential figure, and many of his followers began referring to him as Father and the Prophet. He and his church emphasized helping the poor and people who had been marginalized by society. In the 1970s, his church had spread to major cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles, California. By the late 1970s, his following had grown to nearly 20,000 people. To continue to grow his following and bring more money to his cause, Jones began promising miracles like reading minds and the ability to cure even the most rarest forms of terminal cancer. But instead of pulling cancer out of sick people's bodies in front of huge crowds, he was pulling bits of rotten chicken from behind them. He worked the crowds like a skilled magician. Other people were drawn to Jones' elusive anti-war and anti-capitalist views. As the People's Temple grew, so did Jim Jones' popularity among politicians and the press. But as Jones became increasingly popular, the more criticism he received, and the stranger things got behind the closed doors of the People's Temple. On the outside, the People's Temple appeared to be deeply immersed in humanitarian causes in its communities. But on the inside, far more sinister things were happening. The media began referring to the People's Temple as a cult. A cult whose members weren't allowed to leave and didn't have much contact with non-members. They had been cut off from their families and communities. Former members started saying Jones's views and preachings had become too extreme. He manipulated his followers with blackmail and delivered humiliating beatings to those who challenged him. More severe allegations emerged about Jones. Allegations about drug use, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. Not long after the People's Temple relocated to Northern California, Jones began using drugs, which further heightened his paranoia. Then came the allegations of sexual abuse. Allegations were made that some church members were forced to have abortions. Others reported that Jones began receiving sexual favors from some of the female churchgoers. Then finally, reports surfaced that Jones had raped several male members. In December 1973, Jones was arrested and charged with lewd conduct involving a male undercover LAPD vice officer. However, the charges were eventually dismissed. As the negative publicity around the People's Temple and Jones's paranoia grew, Jones began devising a plan to leave California. In the fall of 1973, Jones began looking at different places around the world to relocate. Not long into his search, he settled on Guyana. Years earlier, in 1963, Jones traveled to Guyana and was well received. It was a place that was coming out of a recent revolution, so it seemed like the perfect place for Jones and his followers. By December of that year, Jones traveled to Guyana to pick out a new location, and by the summer of 1974, land and supplies for the new site were purchased. The first group of Jones's followers arrived in December 1974 to run an agricultural cooperative on the land. Back in California, Jones was busy persuading his remaining followers to come with him to Guyana. He made huge promises, like living in a sanctuary free from the negative media in San Francisco and living in a socialist paradise. Jones convinced his followers that life would be better there. The area on a tract of jungle in the small nation of Guyana became known as Jonestown. At the start of 1977, roughly 50 People's Temple followers arrived at Jonestown. Most of them were sent to expand the original settlement by installing more power generators and constructing more houses. Before they could get much work done, Jones demanded that more and more followers come to Jonestown. But there was concern that there wouldn't be enough room for more people. They warned Jones that there was only room for about 200 people. But Jones was adamant. He said the move needed to happen, and it needed to happen now. In May 1977, Jones and about 600 of his followers arrived in Jonestown, and in the next few months, another 400 people arrived. But the Jonestown that Jones promised didn't turn out to be the paradise he described. Members of the People's Church were subjected to long days in the fields and were brutally punished if they disobeyed any of Jones's orders or questioned his authority. When they arrived in Jonestown, their passports and medications were confiscated. Armed guards patrolled the compounds, and any letters or phone calls sent home were closely monitored by Jones and his high-ranking officials. Following the relocation to Jonestown, Jones's drug use and paranoia only got worse. He became increasingly concerned about Jonestown being raided by the U.S. government or destroyed by the media back in the States. So to prepare Jonestown for an attack, he began holding drills to test his followers' readiness for an attack. He called these drills White Nights. On White Nights, he called alert, alert, alert over a loudspeaker, signaling his followers to gather in the center pavilion while armed guards with guns and crossbows surrounded them. By 1978, conditions in Jonestown continued to deteriorate. Most members were required to work hard labor from sunrise to sunset. Then after a long day of work in the fields, they gathered at the center pavilion to listen to Jones preach. Concerns about what was happening in Jonestown reached the United States. By late 1978, U.S. Representative Leo Ryan heard that some people were being held against their will in Jonestown. In November 1978, Ryan decided to travel to Guyana to investigate the claims himself. On November 17th, Ryan and a few reporters were welcomed onto the Jonestown compound. They were met with a dinner and entertainment, including a performance by the camp rock band, the Jonestown Express. Everything about the visit seemed to be going the way Jones planned, until several People's Temple followers pulled Ryan aside and asked him to get them out of Jonestown. One member even slipped Ryan a note that read, "Help us get out of Jonestown." On November 18th, Ryan invited anyone who wanted to leave Jonestown to go with him. Anyone was welcome to go with him on his return trip to the United States. Publicly, none of the members had asked to leave. Others, who wanted out, asked to leave in secret. A total of 16 people asked to leave Jonestown and go with the group back to the United States. Ryan volunteered to stay behind as the truck made its first run to the airstrip to leave Jonestown. Moments later, screams began ringing out, and Congressman Ryan staggered to the front with his shirt covered in blood. He'd been stabbed. Ryan then hurried to join the people in the truck and get away. Suddenly, a vehicle stormed out of the jungle and began firing bullets into the group of people waiting at the airstrip. They were sent by their leader, Jim Jones. The shots only lasted a few seconds, but when it was finished, five people were killed, including NBC cameraman Bob Brown, correspondent Don Harris, San Francisco Chronicle photographer Greg Robinson, Patricia Parks, and Congressman Leo Ryan. The 11 other people at the airstrip pretended to be dead until the shooters drove off. The Jonestown massacre began later that day. Immediately after the shooting, Jones's wife, Marcelyn Jones, made an announcement over the compound's public speaker. She said everything was okay, and she asked everyone to return to their homes. During her announcement, several aides were preparing the poisonous cocktail. The cocktail was a lethal combination of grape flavor aid, several prescription medications, and cyanide. Before November 18th, Jones obtained a large amount of cyanide and had it delivered to Jonestown. To get that amount of cyanide, he obtained a jeweler's license to legally buy it under the claim he was using it to clean gold. But now it's clear that Jones's intentions of buying a large amount of cyanide was for something other than cleaning gold. Cyanide is the element of this concoction that makes it truly deadly. Only 30 minutes after Marcelyn's announcement to return home, her husband, Jim Jones, made an announcement of his own over the compound speaker. He ordered everyone to meet him at the center pavilion immediately. And when Jones made an order, everyone listened. Once all the members gathered at the center of Jonestown, Jones began preaching to his followers. 44 minutes of Jones's speech were captured on cassette tape, known now as the death tape. This 44-minute tape describes the final moments at Jonestown. Here is a small excerpt of the death tape.
What's going to happen here in a matter of a few minutes is that one of those people on that plane is going to shoot the pilot. I know that. I didn't plan it, but I know it's going to happen. They're going to shoot that pilot, and down comes that plane into the jungle. And we had better not have any of our children left when it's over, because they'll parachute in here on us. I'm telling you just as plain as I know how to tell you, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you. I know that's what's going to happen. That's what he intends to do. And he will do it. He'll do it. Fortunately, being so bewildered with many, many pressures on my brain, seeing all these people behave so treasonous, it was just too much for me to put together. But I now know what he was telling me, and it'll happen. If the plane gets in the air, even. So my opinion is that we be kind to children and be kind to seniors and take the portion like they used to take in ancient Greece and step over quietly, because we are not committing suicide. It's a revolutionary act. We can't go back. They won't leave us alone. They're now going back to tell more lies, which means more congressmen. And there's no way, no way we can survive. Anybody wish to? Anyone that has any dissenting opinion, please speak. Yes. You can have an opportunity, but if our children are left, we are going to have them butchered. We can make a strike, but we'll be striking against people that we don't want to strike against. We'd like to get the people who caused this stuff, and if some people here are prepared to know how to do that, to go in town and get Timothy Stone, but there's no plane. There's no plane. You can't catch a plane in time. He's responsible for it. He brought these people to us. He and Deanna Myrtle. But people in San Francisco will not be idle over this. They'll not take our death in vain, you know.
Jones reminded his followers that he did his best to give them a good life at Jonestown. But despite his efforts, a handful of liars have made their lives at Jonestown impossible. He told his followers that someone on that plane headed back to the United States was going to shoot the pilot within a matter of minutes. Then the plane will crash, and then they'll come for the members of Jonestown and torture them. He urged everyone that what they were about to do wasn't suicide. It's a revolutionary act, and they have no other choice. They can't go back and can't let the people on the plane torture them and take their children away. Jones assured them he doesn't fear death, and neither should they. He said, quote, "I don't know what else to say to these people, but to me, death is not a fearful thing. It's living that's cursed. I have never, 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 never seen anything like this before in my life. I've never seen people take the law and do in their own hands and provoke us and try to purposely agitate mother of children. There is no need to finish us. It's not worth living like this. Not worth living like this." End quote. At one point during Jones's speech, a woman voices her concerns about this revolutionary act. She says she isn't ready to die and doesn't want to see all the young children living at Jonestown die either. On the tape, she's heard saying, quote, "I said I'm not ready to die. I look at all the babies and they deserve to live." End quote. But Jones assured the woman that dying would give the children peace. He says, quote, "But don't they deserve much more? They deserve peace." End quote. The woman isn't convinced. She agrees with Jones that things at Jonestown haven't been peaceful, but she doesn't want to die. She said everyone has the right to choose their destiny, and everyone has a right to their own opinion. Jones replied, quote, "I'm not taking it from you. I'm not taking it from you." End quote. Before embarking on what Jones described as the revolutionary act, he had one more thing to say to his followers on the death tape. Quote, "I call on you to quit exciting your children. All they're doing is going to quiet rest. All over and it's good. No, no sorrow that it's all over. I'm glad it's over. No more pain, no more pain. All they do is take a drink. They take it to go to sleep. That's what death is, sleep. Take our life from us. We laid it down. We got tied. We didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide, protesting the conditions of an inhumane world." End quote. The children and the youngest members of the People's Temple were the first to die. Their parents walked up to a tub filled with syringes. Once they got one, they took the syringe filled with the lethal cyanide concoction and dropped a tiny amount into the back of their children's mouths. The Valium inside the mixture was used to sedate and put the children to sleep, while the cyanide killed them. Once the parents used a syringe to drop the poison into their children's mouths, it took less than 5 minutes for them to die, and even less amount of time for the babies. On the death tape, one woman is heard saying, quote, "There's nothing to worry about, so everyone keep calm and try and keep your children calm. And the oldest children can help love the little children and reassure them. They're not crying from pain. It's just a little bitter tasting, but they're not crying out from any pain." End quote. But that's simply not true. Instead, Many parents watched as their children screamed out in pain from the cyanide poisoning. In many cases, the cyanide worked faster than the Valium. First, the body starts to convulse. Then the mouth is filled with a mixture of vomit and blood. The body becomes completely deprived of oxygen. It can take several minutes before the child passes out and eventually dies. Once the children died, it was the adults' turn. They took a cup and poured themselves a glass of the poison. After drinking it, they were led down a wooden walkway outside the compound. As they walked out, waiting for the cyanide to take effect, Jones could be heard on the tape saying, quote, "Die with a degree of dignity. Lay down your life with dignity. Don't lay down with tears and agony," end quote. One by one, people drank the grape-flavored poison. To mask the bitter almond taste of cyanide, Flavor Aid was mixed in. Flavor Aid had become the drink of choice around Jonestown because it was cheaper than Kool-Aid. At the time of the massacre, more than 900 people lived on the compound, but it was only built to hold 500. Most meals consisted of white rice and small pieces of cheap meat. When they got Flavor Aid with meals, it was considered a treat. As the adults took their turns drinking the poison, some could be seen waiting in line for their turn to die. Others are seen walking around like they're in a trance. The effects of the poison took a little longer for the adults compared to the children. Sometimes it took up to 20 minutes to die. So for 20 minutes, some people experienced the horrifying effects of cyanide poison before eventually passing out. As more adults and seniors were poisoned, the horrific scene intensified. Adults began screaming and crying before dropping to the ground. Those who didn't take the poison yet froze in horror. It looked and sounded like a painful way to die. But saying no to poison was impossible. So while the adults took turns, armed guards stood around the pavilion to ensure no one got away. Everyone at Jonestown was going to die. It was either death by poison or death by an armed guard. By the end of the night, the massacre was over. A total of 900 people died that day, 5 at the airstrip, 4 in Georgetown, and 909 men, women, and children in Jonestown. Approximately 1/3 of those killed in Jonestown were children. November 18, 1978 became the most deadly, single, non-natural disaster in U.S. history until September 11, 2001. Jim Jones was also found dead. His body was among the first to be identified through fingerprints. But unlike his devout followers, Jones didn't drink the poison. Instead, he died from a gunshot wound to the head. His death was believed to be quicker and less painful than most of his followers. When people discovered what happened in Jonestown, Jones's dead body was found sprawled out on the stage in the compound's pavilion. There was a pistol on his chest and a single gunshot wound to his head. Toxicology reports didn't find any traces of cyanide in his system. Most experts who have studied the Jonestown massacre over the years believe Jones shot and killed himself. But no one can say with 100% certainty that someone else didn't shoot him. The autopsy found that the single bullet entered his left temple and exited the right. However, the first pathologist to arrive on the scene reported the entrance bullet was on the right side of his head. If Jones was right-handed, something that hasn't been confirmed, a gunshot wound to the left side of his head would have been very difficult. Authorities also couldn't perform gunshot residue tests on Jones's hands. But if Jones didn't pull the trigger on himself, who did? Some reports suggest that Annie Moore, a close friend and personal nurse to Jones, may have done it. Moore is considered one of the last people to die in Jonestown that day. But this theory doesn't seem likely. Annie Moore died from a gunshot wound from a different gun and at a different location. She also left behind a suicide note where she praised Jones for what he did for the People's Temple. So the more likely and more popular theory is that Jim Jones shot and killed himself. But to this day, this hasn't been confirmed. Over 900 people were killed that day, and only 33 people survived. According to CNN, 11 people fled Jonestown through the jungle. They included 5 members of the same family. The youngest to escape into the jungle was 3 years old, and the oldest was 42. The group of 11 survivors walked almost 30 miles through the jungle to another town. 14 people lived through the airstrip ambush that killed U.S. Congressman Ryan. The youngest to survive was 12 years old, and the oldest was 64. 4 people were reportedly sent away by Jones or his mistresses, and 5 people managed to live through the mass suicides in Jonestown. Reports suggest that at least 2 people who were intended to be poisoned managed to survive. One survivor claimed he laid down in a ditch and pretended to be dead. There is another report of a 76-year-old woman who realized what was happening and crawled under her bed. She didn't come out until everyone was dead. Several suicide notes were found throughout the compound. Most notable was the suicide note reportedly written by Jones. In part, the note reads, quote, "Please try to understand. Look at all. Look at all in perspective. Look at Jonestown. See what we have tried to do. This was a monument to life, to the renewal of human spirit, broken by capitalism, by a system of exploitation and injustice. We did not want this kind of ending. We wanted to live, to shine, to bring light to a world that is dying for a little bit of love. To those left behind of our loved ones, many of whom will never understand, who never knew the truth, grieve not. We are grateful for this opportunity to bear witness, a bitter witness. History has chosen our destiny in spite of our own desire to forge our own. We were at cross purpose with history. But we are calm in this hour of our collective leave-taking. As I write these words, people are silent, taking a quick potion, including sleep, relief," end quote. More than 400 unclaimed bodies of the Jonestown Massacre are buried at the Evergreen Cemetery in Oakland, California, where many of Jones's followers originated. In 2008, a stone memorial to the Jonestown victims were built at Evergreen. In 2001, 4 additional memorial plaques were placed at the site with the names of all 918 people killed. This new memorial also includes the name of Jim Jones. In the aftermath of the Jonestown Massacre, experts for decades have attempted to explain why it happened. What drove Jim Jones to lead over 900 people to mass suicide? What motivated his followers to believe in him to the point of suicide? And can what happened in Jonestown ever happen again? Jim Jones began his rise to power when he was only 22 years old. He started his first church in 1953. Despite not being formally ordained, he quickly became a prominent figure in the church community. He particularly appealed to people interested in racial and social equality. For many people, Jim Jones was different. He wasn't like any church leader. Because he was different, people were instantly drawn to him and his beliefs. He also used his charm to appeal to people. From an early age, Jones had a charismatic personality. He was also a smooth talker. So naturally, when he spoke, people were drawn to him. They wanted to hear him talk more. Every time Jones spoke, he seemed genuine and passionate. He knew the Bible inside and out, so people immediately trusted him. As Jones's popularity grew and his following grew, his need to remain in control over his followers also grew. At one point, Jones was believed to have over 20,000 followers. 20,000 people is a lot of people to handle. Jones quickly learned it would be difficult to control fully functioning adults with their own thoughts and their own ideas. So how exactly did he gain that needed control? Many experts believed that Jones used humiliation and degradation. Although Jones's followers weren't allowed to have sex, Jones would often punish people by making them perform sexual acts in front of others. He would also force people to strip naked and publicly criticize their bodies, and encourage others watching to join in on the criticism. He took men's wives away from them so that he could have sex with them. He forced people to drink their own urine and eat their own vomit. And it wasn't only the adults who became the targets. Almost one third of the people to die in Jonestown were children. Over 300 children were killed. And leading up to the massacre, children weren't exempt from the abuse. Allegations have been made that children were routinely beaten if they disobeyed. Some of them were even tortured by electric shock. Further allegations report that some children on the compound may have been sexually abused. He would terrorize and beat the children right in front of their parents' eyes. Jones also used threats of blackmail to elevate his control. Surveillance, secret filming, and filmed confessions were common in Jonestown. Jones was known to force people into confessing to crimes they didn't commit, like making one individual confess to assassinating John F. Kennedy. He would then keep the taped confessions and use them as blackmail if the people disobeyed, or if Jones felt like they would leave. Jones was known to make people hold guns that they were told were murder weapons so their fingerprints would be on the suspected murder weapon. This was another method of blackmail to make sure they would do whatever Jones demanded. And if they betrayed Jim Jones, the police would be called. Straight threats of violence were also common. Jones told his followers that if they left the People's Temple, they would be killed by angels. Not only were members afraid for their own lives, but they were also afraid for their loved ones. They feared what might happen to their family members if they were left behind. Sleep deprivation and starvation quickly became powerful tools for Jones to remain in total dominance. The longer people stayed awake, sometimes days on end, the weaker they became, and the more vulnerable. The same with food and water. People living in Jonestown were utterly dependent on Jones for both food and water. Without him, they wouldn't survive. During the last few years of Jones's life, he became heavily involved in drug use. Barbiturates became his drug of choice. The increased drug use caused him to experience terrible mood swings and increasingly erratic behavior. He spent his days popping different medications and drugs throughout his final months, often self-medicating. He even prescribed medications to others, whether they wanted to take them or not. But despite the abuse, humiliation, torture, manipulation, hundreds of people stayed with Jim Jones in Jonestown. They stayed with him to the death. For many, they were in too deep. they were too far along to go back or to walk away. Jones promised his followers that life in Jonestown would be paradise. They would be free from capitalism and live in a utopia. This promise got hundreds of people to leave their homes in the United States and follow him to Guyana. Even when they arrived and realized it wasn't the promise that Jones made, they all stayed. Jonestown quickly became a Twilight Zone reality in which people pretended to be enjoying a utopian existence while living in total and absolute fear for their lives. Now the question, could something like Jonestown happen again? Well, many experts believe the simple answer to that question is yes. Since Jonestown, we've had similar incidents, including those in Waco, Texas. No incident has had as many casualties as Jonestown, but there's a real possibility that something like this will happen again. The people in Jonestown believed in Jim Jones. They followed someone who ultimately led them to destruction. Even after he stole from them, abused them, lied to them, cheated, they still followed him to the end because they trusted him. If someone like Jim Jones can gain the trust of many people, then something similar to Jonestown can absolutely happen in the future. Decades after the mass suicides in Jonestown, mourners still gather to remember loved ones lost in the massacre each year. For those grievers, the pain of Jonestown is still raw. For others who came afterward, the event is simply a day in history. A day in history popularized the phrase drinking the Kool-Aid. The phrase drinking the Kool-Aid or don't drink the Kool-Aid was inspired by the Jonestown massacre. The phrase typically has a negative connotation and refers to someone who blindly believes in something or something. They believe in it for its perceived potential for high rewards. The phrase can also refer to someone accepting an idea or changing a preference based on peer pressure, popularity, or persuasion. Today, the term drinking the Kool-Aid is typically used to be funny or ironic. But for those connected to Jonestown, it's become a derogatory phrase. In February 2012, Drinking the Kool-Aid won first place in an online poll by Forbes magazine as, quote, the single most annoying example of business jargon, end quote. Over the years, the phrase has become a popular workplace term for coworkers drinking the company's Kool-Aid. The events that took place on November 18, 1978 will forever stay in the history books as the Jonestown Massacre. That day, over 900 people lost their lives, and about a third of them were young children. All of them were promised by their leader, Jim Jones, that they were doing a revolutionary act by ingesting the cyanide-laced drink. Many of those who died that day were poisoned against their will. The term used to describe November 18, 1978 has evolved over the years. Some experts call the deaths a mass suicide. Others call it mass murder suicide because many victims were injected against their will. Still, others refer to Jonestown as a massacre or simply mass murder. Whatever you call what happened on November 18, 1978 in Jonestown, a massacre, a mass murder-suicide, the facts remain the same. 918 people died in a single day in a single event. The Jonestown Massacre became the most deadly, single, non-natural disaster in U.S. history until September 11, 2001. We might not ever fully understand why Jonestown happened, But here are some of my personal thoughts and opinions on how Jones rose to power. Jim Jones used his charm to gain followers. He was different than any other church leader at the time. And because he was so different, people followed him. They were attracted to him. At first, in the early years, I think he gained followers by his charm and personality. He just had a way with words. And when he spoke, people listened. But over time, as the months went by and the years went by, he had to work much harder to maintain control. That's when his charm and his personality wore off. When he thought people might leave the church, he then turned to violence. He turned to physical, emotional, and sexual abuse to keep people at Jonestown. I think he knew that a lot of people wanted out. But at the end of the day, he wasn't going to let that happen. In my opinion, Jones always knew that this might be the outcome someday. If it meant breaking up his church, he was willing to do whatever it took to stay in control, including mass suicide and a suicide of his own. I think Jones started planning this, at least really planning it, when he started purchasing large amounts of cyanide. I think he wanted to have it on hand in the event that he needed to use it. And then after what happened, after the shooting at the airstrip that killed our congressman, I think he already knew what he was about to do and set the plans in motion, because this was something that he knew for months, if not years, that he was going to do if he felt like he was losing control. And at the end of the day, control and power meant everything to him. In my opinion, what happened at Jonestown was the combination of a perfect storm. Jones was a narcissist who sought to have total and complete control over his followers. And his followers were caught up in everything. They were in way too deep and didn't think that they could get out even if they wanted to. His followers were also stuck with a groupthink mentality. Many of them, they simply had no way out. Jim Jones took advantage of people. He used lies, manipulation, and abuse to maintain control. And in the end, he's responsible for the deaths of over 900 people, including over 300 children. If you or someone you know is in crisis, dial the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988 provides 24/7 free and confidential support for people in distress. They also provide prevention and crisis resources for you and your loved ones. That's 988. Anatomy of a Massacre is a Rockefeller Audio production. If you like the show and would like to support it, there are a number of ways you can help. For a small monthly contribution, you can help create new compelling cases for the show, help fund research, and assist with production and editing costs. For supporting the show, you'll become one of the first to listen to new ad-free episodes and snag exclusive show merchandise not available anywhere else. To learn about how you can support the show, head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/anatomyofamassacre, or simply click the link in the show notes. You can also support the show by subscribing and leaving a positive review. Sources for this episode include articles from History, Rolling Stone, AETV, The New York Times, PBS, and APA.